Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest is Rodney Shakespeare. Rodney's been on many times. We'll cover lots of important ground on major, major stuff going on, and there's never a shortage. My goodness, so we've got the Ukraine situation. The conflict is in an interregnum stage. It certainly hasn't ended. I expect it to heat up any time at Washington's discretion because Washington pulls the strings. It decides. The Ukrainian government is simply a stooge government put in by Washington. You got Obama's Iraq War III. You got the situation heating up even worse in Syria, with Obama getting ready to conduct a bombing campaign against not the extremist forces, the Islamic State, but really that's the pretext, targeting the Syrian government the Syrian government is the target, and the objective is regime change. It's outrageous, Rodney, that yesterday the so-called president, the oligarch president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, addressed the joint session of the Canadian Parliament, and he literally was feted. He was given a red carpet treatment. He was, all kinds of adulation was thrown at him. I mean, they treated him like visiting royalty. And today, Rodney, he's in Washington. He'll meet with Obama at the Oval Office. I mean, this guy is a crook. He's a fascist. He's a neoliberal. He's an anti-democrat. Democratic advocate, and he'll meet with Obama. He'll address a joint session of the U.S. Congress, and they will treat him like visiting royalty. They ought to put the guy in prison. I don't know why he ever got an invitation to come. Well, of course I know why he got an invitation to come, because he's Washington's man in Kiev. My God. Yes. I wrote an article about this morning.
Yes, and he's also a liar, and the parallel is the Nazi-Soviet pact, where both sides agreed peace with each other when they, certainly in the case of the Nazis, had no intention of keeping that peace. And Poroshenko has only made peace, a tentative peace at the moment on the surface, because his troops were smashed by the rebels of the Donetsk Republic and the Luhansk Republic, and he's just repeated, in order to get the arms which are now coming in from the NATO countries, to get the training, and then he's going to go back into war, and he will slaughter. There's been more killing, I think, per day in eastern Ukraine than there was in Gaza, and that was bad enough. The situation, I'm afraid, in Ukraine is appears to have died down for the moment, but then you look at the factors, the economic factors, the whole thing is on a collapse. Ukraine is not paying for its gas. Russia will pull the plug, bound to pull the plug on the gas. They can't just go on sending gas forever. The Americans are trying to take over the whole thing so they can earn the own the agricultural products, enterprises, and the industrial enterprises, particularly in the east. But of course, their ultimate aim is to put in the NATO missiles right on Russia's borders. So I'm afraid, Steve, I'm going to say it now, you're in a temporary lull, but behind it, you, just as the Zionists, do whatever they like because they know they've got the Americans behind them. So I'm afraid you're going to have Poroshenko and the fascist thugs, they're going to attack because they have said they won't allow anything that's near what the people of the East want. So it's a lull, but then there's going to be an attack coming from Kiev, and Russia will have no alternative but to take action. They cannot sit back and allow a continued slaughter of the people of the East.
the way I see it coming, Rodney, is an old-fashioned false flag. You know, there'll be something manipulated false flag style, and the crimes of Kiev will be blamed on the freedom fighters of southeastern Ukraine. And, of course, the Western media machine, the propaganda machine, will spread these big lies. And this is the way I see something happening. And right now, the Ukrainian military was battered because the self-defense forces got the better of a very disheartened and uninterested rank-and-file military force, soldiers who wanted no part of fighting their own citizens, and a lot of them simply just abandoned their arms, crossed the border safe haven into Russia, or went home, or deserted, or joined the ranks of the self-defense forces. So it's an interregnum period, as you say, Rodney. The Ukrainian military is regrouping. America is rearming. NATO and America is helping Ukraine rearm.
Yes, but you talk about a false flag, but there's already been a huge false flag. Since you and I were last talking, there has been the interim report, as it's called, on the bringing down of the airliner MH17.
Oh, yes, yes.
And this has to be one of the most extraordinary documents the world's ever seen. This preliminary report actually says that there were a whole large number of very fast-moving projectiles. And, Steve, they're indicating that they're coming from both sides of the plane and they're all going into the cockpit and coming from slightly below. Now, why don't they say the truth? That cannot be a missile. It can only be an attack by one fighter plane making a pass and then possibly coming back, or by two fighter planes, one coming in and going over the plane and the other one coming in and going over the plane. But, of course, Steve, they are going to talk about false flag. This isn't a false flag. It's some sort of monstrous Nazi. I don't know how to explain something on a hiding up on this scale. They're putting the thing out and sort of trying to draw the teeth, as it were, of the critics. And then when eventually the truth does seep out, when people start demanding, why aren't the Americans showing their satellite information? Why aren't we seeing the interviews with Carlos, the Kiev traffic controller? Why has he been disappeared from the face of the earth? Why was the plane put over the war zone? But in particular, the evidence of the cockpit, which is riddled with bullet holes. And there you can even probably work out this would be an anti-tank cannon, which was raked into that cockpit coming from slightly from below. But why are they not doing anything about it? The answer is a false flag attack. Seven countries allegedly involved, including Malaysia, for God's sake, have agreed that nothing will be published unless all seven agree at once. What on earth are they going on? They've been maneuvered into the biggest whitewash of a false flag attack on the same scale as 9/11. So, Steve, I'm going to have to agree with you. Since they're not actually at war at this moment, they may have to go for another false flag attack. But it's difficult to see what that might be, having already murdered just under 300 people.
Well, they can keep pulling him off forever, Rodney. Obama thought he had a perfect way to get involved directly as opposed to waging a proxy war against Syria. Last summer, last August, the chemical attack in Ghouta erroneously blamed on the Assad government. He had nothing to do with it. The extremist fighters, al-Nusra, whoever was responsible for this, they're the ones who pull off the attack. But Obama thought he had a perfect way to get America directly involved and mass public opposition to another war, whether it's in Syria or any place else, I imagine, got Congress to absolutely turn thumbs down on this, and Obama had to back off. But he didn't end his war plans. He simply postponed them, and now they're being reactivated again. So you had that. You got the bringing down of the Malaysian plane, absolute cannon fire. One or more Ukrainian warships opened fire on this plane, riddled it with bullet holes, and brought the plane down. It had nothing to do with Russia, had nothing to do with the self-defense forces, had nothing to do with a ground-to-air missile. It was the Ukrainian government in league with Washington bringing down this plane to use it as a pretext to do all the other things they had in mind.
Steve, I think you'll find there were two JU-15, is it JU-17 Ukrainian fighters up there. And the Americans have got the evidence because they would have the satellite evidence.
Oh, absolutely.
Looking down on the planes going across there. And they would actually show the two planes approaching, and then it would show the movement away from its course of the airliner. These were close-range, deliberate killing of all the crew, and that is why you get nothing on the, what are those called, black box recorders. They would have sort of blown out the communications of the plane in a blast of fire, of bullet fire. This is very, very serious. This is a deliberate shooting down, starting with the pilots and collapsing the plane that way. Kerry is still repeating this lie about Assad used gas. You're quite right. They're bringing it back again, because the line they're doing now in Syria is, of course, that they're claiming to do attack ISIL. Well, as we know, the USA was one of those training and arming ISIL itself. Then they sort of changed to arming these so-called moderates, who whereupon immediately get defeated. And if they weren't the ISIL in disguise, end up handing their arms over to ISIL. And a failed policy, Steve, is now going to be done, twice over, three times over, should we say about five times over. The failed policy is actually going to be done five times over. Turkey is playing an extraordinary game. It's going to be the same as what Israel's going to do. The Turkish people are saying, we're going to have to put up a buffer zone against these naughty ISIS people. And that means we're going to have to invade part of Syria and have a sort of protective zone. Oh, yes. And where is the border through which all the ISIS are moving into Turkey, having had rest and recuperation and being fed and watered and then put back again? It's, of course, the Turkish border. And then there will be Israel. Already Israel, we know, is already in occupation of the Golan Heights. And Israel is going to claim that it needs a buffer zone against Syria. And in this way, they intend carving Syria up into pieces. But Steve, I want to ask your view on this. Presumably, there's going to be some sort of agreement, secret agreement, maybe, between Syria and the Americans not to shoot down the planes, or that the Americans are only going to go in certain areas. And how is that going to work? And where is the Russians in all of this? They've had ample time to put in very solid, highly efficient anti-aircraft defenses. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think that Syria will contest American warplanes coming over its territory, either for surveillance or to bomb supposed Islamic State areas. You remember, Rodney, and I've written about it several times, that over the years, Israel has conducted bombing raids against Syria on its territory. Syria never one time responded. Israel is no slouch when it comes to a powerful military, but America, of course, is the world's most powerful military. So if this happens, Syria won't contest it, because it knows that means all-out war with America. The gloves are off, and America will come full force with a huge bombing campaign. I'm very concerned about Russia. I wish Russia would draw a line on another program with another guest. We discussed this, that Russia has so much influence. It's the only other nation that can match America blow for blow with its powerful nuclear arsenal and its precision, its long-range delivery systems, and its precision accuracy when it wants to attack various targets. Russia could draw a red line and say you can go so far and no further. And if you go so further, it can at least imply what it will do in response. And I don't think America wants to get into an open war with Russia at this time. I feel we're heading for something like that, Rodney. But I don't think that's in the cards at this particular time. But if Russia really took an awfully strong stance and simply laid its cards on the table and said we simply won't tolerate any more than this, it's possible that could have an effect to get America to back off a little bit. But short of that, Washington, Obama knows that he can do anything he wants and get away with it. So we've got the Iraq situation, the Ukrainian situation. We have the war without mercy, as I like to call it, and I believe it will be reactivated. Again, it'll probably be more vicious than the first time. So thousands of Ukrainians, maybe there have been thousands already killed or injured, and I think there'll be many more killed or injured once this thing gets going again. And the situation in Syria, where Obama is literally heading toward direct U.S. involvement with a bombing campaign and who knows what else, using extremist fighters, al-Nusra and the Islamic State, to fight the Syrian government. They've already captured the border area, the Quneitra governance, the border area, a fairly large area on the border between Syria and Israel, Rodney, and they want to use that as a launching ground to help some of their allies in other parts of Syria, and also to use it to be able to advance on the Damascus. It's only 40 miles from Damascus. I think this is the plan, to advance on Damascus. It's up to the Syrian government to do something. But again, Rodney, I'd like to see Russia get more involved. And what I fear is that Russia, I think, will draw the line on Ukraine, but will not draw it on Syria.
Well, on Syria, I mean, I would like to see what's being done about Christians. I think the world's oldest Christian communities are in Syria, and yet they've been slaughtered. And if I may say so, the American Christian Zionists were doing nothing. Those Christian Zionists are essentially Zionists and not Christians. And it was only when the Zionists put up those photographs, those gruesome images of the slaughter of two journalists, not 200,000 people who were being killed and made misery, that America decides to take action. I must say, Steve, is that if you ever want any evidence of the complete control of Zionism and Americans' foreign policy, the Syrian situation probably is that. And any Christian Zionist listening to this program ought to be damn well ashamed of themselves. I'll say it again. You are not Christians. You are Zionists, you people. And you are supporting war and disaster in the Middle East. And you did not lift a finger when the Christians of Syria were being slaughtered. Steve, very quickly on Ukraine, I do think in the long run that Russia holds the cards. The Ukrainian economy is a complete and absolute basket case, that nothing's going to save it. Nothing's going to stop their gas supply being cut. The sanctions are not going to affect Russia. They're affecting Europe. There's been quite a business going on now in Spain and France and to some extent even the UK as we lose the markets for our agriculture products, which markets are not coming back. And we know that Russia, for example, could stop the car market. And there are plenty of others who willingly. The only effect of putting sanctions on Russia is to guarantee it would take what it wants from elsewhere in the world, and at the same time to make more effort in making its own economy independent. If I was a Russian, I would be taking my hat off and saying, thank God, at last we've got some sanctions and we can break away from any sort of lever and carry on. There should be, I mean, I know they're saying at this moment that the ruble has been going down as a result of all this, but that's just the Western global system trying to put the screws on Russia. The actual physical realities are that I don't think Russia's going to be affected at all by these sanctions. Maybe on the banking transactions there can still be some problems, but as we know, Russia is moving like lightning to tie up with the BRIC countries, the India, China, South Africa, etc., making deals which don't depend on settling in dollars. So the effect of all this is accentuating the move of global economic power from west to east. It's actually, even though the Western media are totally controlled, it's accentuating what is going to be the loss of American political power and a reminder that American moral authority has gone. Because, as you say, Steve, there is a limit to the number of false flag attacks. This MH17 one, I mean, let every person listening to this program look up the preliminary report and remember that hundreds of extremely fast-moving projectiles coming from outside the plane hitting the cockpit, and every one of those looks like a bullet. It could not have been a missile, Steve.
This is the preliminary report from The Hague.
Yes, this is the preliminary report from The Hague, and it's a sort of the trick where you sort of half admit something but don't actually admit it, and then you just do it again 6 months later, and you just go on, and then eventually everyone says, well, what does it matter now? It's all too late.
There have been a lot of good articles written about the MH17, Rodney, and I wrote one myself. I quoted information from the Malaysian Straits Times that basically said a ground-to-air missile had nothing to do with bringing the plane down. It was cannon fire from an aircraft, a Ukrainian aircraft, maybe two Ukrainian aircrafts, right in the Straits Times from Malaysia.
It's not so much. It's now missiles. It's bullets. It's bullish. By the way, the Straits Times, of course, I think I've said before, that has the best English in the world. Right? I mean, you should read that paper for learning how to write. I don't have to lecture you. You write very well. But everybody else, ordinary people like me, we need to read the Straits Times to learn to improve our English style.
Well, okay. I read that article in their explanation of MH17. By the way, Roddy, I want to say something about the sanctions. I think in the long run, the sanctions can actually help Russia rather than hurt Russia.
Yes.
It's getting Russia to be less dependent on the West. It's turning east. The energy deal that Russia and China consummated, probably the greatest, the largest trade deal in history, worth countless tens of billions of dollars, a 30-year deal that could really end up being a century-long deal, but hundreds of billions of dollars involved in this deal, and Russia is negotiating a trade with other eastern countries as opposed to western countries, and you hit the nail on the head, Rodney. America doesn't have an enormous amount of trade with Russia. It's fairly modest, but European countries do have an enormous amount of trade, hundreds of billions of dollars, and they succumb to Washington pressure to put sanctions on with their business interests absolutely 100% oppose them. And leaders like Angela Merkel and David Cameron, Francois Hollande, they went ahead and they did this anyway, shooting themselves in the foot. They'll end up the losers. Russia will end up the winner. Short term, you know, you can't look at the short term. You've got to look at the long term. But already Russia has benefited. Before the sanctions came into effect, they had this enormous deal, energy deal, with China that was in the works for many, many years, and a tremendous deal involving more than just energy, involving other technology and other products. So a tremendous trade deal. China, of course, is the one country to link up with trade deals, but you've got India, you've got other countries, and these are the things that Russia is looking to, and I think it's got very willing partners in the trade that it wants to negotiate. And also, as you say, getting out from under trading in the U.S. dollar, bilaterally trading in their own currencies, which is wonderful.
Well, You talked about Merkel and Cameron and Hollande shooting themselves in the foot. Well, yes, and they are doing this at a time when their left foot is already injured, so they're shooting themselves in the right.
Yes.
The European economy really is in serious trouble, Steve. You can take your official statistics, which are a lie. You double them to get, which is very roughly about what the level is, and then you double that again for young people between the ages of 18 and 25. And then you look at certain areas where you're on 60, 70, even 80% of young people unemployed or on just part-time jobs. And these countries are Portugal, Italy, and increasingly France. Hollande, elected, going to change the world. The next thing, he's behaving like the straight neocon, mainstream neoclassical person, upholding the Maastricht Treaty, which refuses to allow him to take direct action to ensure that people have work and jobs. And we know what the answer must be. For starters, it has to be the use of the central bank to produce a big capital public infrastructure. That is the first thing you must do. And if you don't do that, You're going to get what you're getting now throughout Europe. You're going to get a lot of miserable people, a lot of distressed people, and the rise of new political movements. It's no good saying that in Marine Le Pen in France, the Front National is a right-wing movement because of this or because of that. It's a movement, but it's impelled by a lot of disconcerted and upset people who are being stimulated by economic malaise more than anything else. And that's certainly true in Italy. And goodness me, I believe it to be true in the UK. And I'm talking about Scotland now. At this moment, Steve, they're reckoning that you're going to have an 80%. Today, by the way, is the referendum.
Yes, and they're voting right now.
They're voting right now. And the government, and this links with Europe, the government, the UK government, said there must be a simple question. You either vote for going independent or you vote against. And they, of course, were smirking their heads off because they said, well, we'll put it like that. And people, no way will they vote for going independent. They didn't put the third option, which would have been, do you want a Scotland with a greater devolved powers? Anyway, they put it in a yes or no situation. And, of course, at last that I knew is that, roughly speaking, it could go one way or another. And that seems to be the view at the moment. There's no more evidence that we'll know until the results come out. But the point is this, is that behind that movement of wanting to go for a new national solution, it's the same sort of movement as you've got in Catalonia in northeast Spain. Here again, it's regional, but behind it is hitting on the economic malaise. Catalonia is the most prosperous part of Spain, but it is affected by economic malaise, the same as all the other parts are. But even in Germany, for heaven's sake, there's now getting 10% of the electorate voting for an anti-euro party, which is significantly hitting aspects of the finance. Steve, the problem is that the Europe is structured so that it only has one solution, and that solution is actually based on the fact that just cling on and everything will be all right, and you must always allow the banks to control the thing for their benefit, and you must never think directly of the benefit of the mass of the population. There are solutions that can be done, but they are still based on the assumption cling on and everything will be all right. But the people are revolting. In country after country, you're looking at roughly 25%. I mean, in the UK, and if you look at England, for example, say in the UK here, not in the UK, but in England, a part of UK, you're looking on 25% who are going to vote for Nigel Farage and the UK Independence Party. And that party really does not have any economic solutions, but it represents a profound malaise of people who say, we think the whole structure in some way, perhaps we don't quite understand why, the whole structure is false and it is failing. Now let's look now at Scotland itself. The problem here is, Steve, that it doesn't really matter, I say, which way the vote goes. That first of all, if it goes no, then you can be sure that the yes people will continue their fight. If it goes yes, you can be sure that the no people will refuse to allow any effective independence. And, Steve, in any case, I think it has to be said that what is meant by Scottish independence at this moment really is nothing of the sort. Alex Salmond seems to have ruled out his own currency and has handed control over to London by saying they want to keep the pound. What a huge mistake. Alex Salmond has not done saying, well, we'll stay out of Europe. Because if you are in Europe, it seems to be nothing but trouble. And he says they want to go into a Europe. As I understand it, I think they're still going to be part of NATO, which, by the way, Steve, as you know, was formed in 1948, wasn't it, as a purely defensive organization. And yet since 1992, when roughly round about there, assurances were given to Gorbachev and crew that NATO would not expand across towards Russia, NATO has become an instrument of aggressive policy. At first, there seemed to be moral issues, but of later years, it is now a straight aggressive institution. In the case of Scotland, it looks to me that with the exception of they may try to get rid of the nuclear base, they are asking for nothing but trouble. Steve, if you don't have your own money supply, which you then use for your productive capacity, which you must use to spread the ownership of productive capacity so that people not only produce, that they can consume in a very real way. If you aren't prepared to do that, don't bother going independent. You're just being controlled by other people for their purposes, which have nothing to do with yours. Now, Scotland has got some marvelous natural resources, but people don't know there are tidal races. These are things underneath the surface of the water, off the Pentland Firth, so we say in Scotland. And these are very powerful, whooping currents. And you just put a great slow-turning windmill underneath the surface of the water, and you let it get on with it. It doesn't harm the fish or do anything, and the boats go over on top. It's got wave power. The Salter duck, invented by Dr. Salter of Edinburgh. The damn thing works, Steve. The only problem is that whenever they put them on the waves and the thing starts working, it seems that any storm blows away the tethers. You think that they could hold the thing, but no, it gets blown away or shoved away by the wind and the waves. There is a normal tidal energy, and there's hydroelectric energy. And there are also other possibilities now. Scotland's into the north, but even solar now is starting to play a part. I don't think wind ever will, and not a serious part. But they're saying that within 10 years at least, or perhaps earlier, Scotland could be entirely neutral as regards energy. And on top of that, it's got the oil. Steve, all this is up for negotiation, and London isn't going to give an inch. If people vote for independence, do you think London's going to say, oh, yes, carry on, and we're going to give you all the oil? Because, you see, if you draw the median line, it's one of the methods by which you can decide where a country's boundaries are. But they can all be argued about. And believe you me, put this up on your wall and note it now. It's every single thing's going to be argued about by London because they never expected, they never wanted, and they hadn't any intention allowing Scotland to be independent. And what are they going to do? Give away 80% of the oil revenue upon which we borrow money at the moment. And if Scotland votes for independence, 80% of the oil revenue, or even 85% has gone towards Scotland, where is the security for England's borrowing? Steve, there's a lot of ructions and trouble to come. My real grump in all this is that I don't think there's a strong enough determination on the part of the Scottish people to go independent and take a new course. I think there's too much of, oh, well, we'll continue as we are. And as we are, the Barnett formula is one of a British government formula for reallocating, redistributing resources. It seems to have favoured Scotland for a long time.
Right, and I agree with you that if by some chance the yes vote wins, I really don't expect it, but if it happens, Britain will never allow losing the things that it values most, the oil and so on and so forth. I mean, it will fight tooth and nail to keep as much of the status quo as possible. What also concerns me is I think it would be wonderful to have an independent Scotland with a completely different system than the one that rules the entire UK now. I mean, a socially egalitarian system, an anti-war system. I mean, this would be absolutely wonderful, but it won't happen. You could get
but it
a
won't
new
happen.
Government.
They're setting the thing up with a sort of vague ideals, and the actual realities are, I don't even think they're going to succeed at getting rid of that nuclear base, because what will happen is that a long-term lease will be negotiated. You know, you do this sort of thing for Guam or for the Ascension Islands, for example, where the thing is a British thing, and you negotiate a long-term lease to the Americans. I can't actually see a new way forward, because they didn't take the bull by the horns, and which was in fact to say that they would control their own money supply and they would break from Europe and go for totally new thinking. They want, Steve, something which is socially fairer. They don't want to charge their students huge sums of money. They want to maintain the thoroughly admirable health service. And by the way, in this country, our health service costs just under half what is the cost of that in America.
Oh.
And we do have access, or all have access to that.
But of course, you're heading for privatization, Rodney.
Well, yes, I tell you why. You spotted that one, eh? They screwed the thing up so that all the hospital trusts have actually suddenly gone millions and millions of pounds into debt, you see. And the next move will be saying, oh, look, they're all in debt. But by screw, I mean that they actually took maneuvers which ensured that to force the trusts, which run the hospitals and things, into debt. And the next move will be saying, they'll be saying, this is the, will be the excuse, look, they're all in debt, they're all totally efficient, we must sell them off. Steve, it would be complete and absolute disaster. It just so happens I was with someone at lunchtime today, and I was putting my eagle, we went to one of London's big hospitals, I put my eagle eye around, and the whole thing was working in a very orderly, democratic, and highly organized way. And I have reason to tell you that for one reason or another, I'm not really aware that there's any serious griping of people who have to use the National Health Services. What the griping is, it's purely political. It's the sort of thing you get in America. Now, they jump up and they talk about socialism. Americans have no idea what socialism is. They've absolutely no idea at all. It's just a language of abuse. And it always then ends up the whole thing being sold out to a very, very narrow group who don't have the interests of the mass of the population. And we've got the same thing in the UK. They want to sell off the national health to a tiny group of people for the benefit of a tiny group of people, in exactly the same way your big corporations are. The military-industrial complex don't concern a damn about anything as long as they make money. Alternatively, they are concerned with getting goods cheaply, and they don't worry about things like where is the consuming power in the American economy. You've exported all your jobs. You get these very narrow interests who's supported by the rhetoric which says that anything they do favors a free economy. Steve, we have to get this out. The idea of a free economy has now been completely and utterly destroyed. The great basis of Adam Smith is that producers and consumers must be the same people. And that means that everybody must have either a job or ownership of a small business or ownership of shares paying out their full dividend value. And if you don't have that, you cannot have a free economy. You've got a perverted thing at this moment, and I'm afraid in your country, our country is now as bad as yours. And the latest one, if you put your finger on it, they're trying to maneuver the thing and to smash up our admirable National Health Service, which does it for about roughly half the cost of what yours does.
When did the service come into effect? Post-World War II, Rodney?
Just after the war. It was in 1945. Churchill thought that he would be rewarded for getting the country through, but in fact, people wanted the political benefit of having suffered and sort the thing through. And there was a huge move towards the left, and under Aneurin Bevan, a Welsh MP, we introduced our National Health Service. And Scotland, I mean, one of the factors, if they vote yes for Scotland, it will be to preserve the Scottish Health Service. The trouble about the health service and its support, Steve, is that a lot of people, particularly young people, they don't realize what the health service is. They're not unhealthy. They're not ill. They don't think that at some stage, what does it matter? When they were children, they went and there was no trouble with the doctors and walked out. They don't really understand what the meaning of the health service is. They don't understand what happens in countries where people have absolutely nothing. And if they do have any money, they have to pay a lot through the nose. And those who don't, frankly, well, they can just stuff it and lump it and die. I mean, you know, people in the UK do not understand what a huge benefit the National Health Service is. Extraordinary.
Yes.
But there you are.
Okay. that situation. The health service, I guess, worked very well for a very long time, but certainly in more recent years, it is really going the way of what's happening in America, where if you can afford the insurance, you can have the health care that you pay for. Most people can't, so even with the system that's U.S. law now, Obamacare, it really is a terrible system. People who had nothing get something, so they benefit. But most Americans literally have something that is far less than what they deserve. The insurance companies still call the shots, hundreds of billions of dollars thrown away to pay insurance premiums when we need to get rid of them and have a system where medical care provides medical care and it doesn't have an intermediary to decide who gets it, how much, and what it should cost. It should be universal. But, of course, that doesn't exist in America.
And they call this socialism, because what Steve, just before I comment on that, what is the situation in Canada very broadly? Do you know?
I think it's being transformed in the wrong direction as well. I haven't written about the Canadian system other than a few remarks here or there, Rodney, but yeah. I think Canada is basically going the way of America, where it will turn everything over. It's still a state-run system, but I think it's heading toward privatization. It may happen very slowly, very incrementally, but I think this is the way Canada is going.
Yes. All the assets and everything are being what's called privatized. And the trouble with privatization, the actual practical meaning, is always the privatization into the hands of a few. Though the great disgrace of America in its health service is, of course, that it actually, what it does, it creates a massive bureaucracy, and it's the shareholders of that bureaucracy administering the thing. Whereas in the UK, most of that administration is simply cut out. We have a much greater proportion of our NHS is spent on the direct provision of services, because they're not in all this arguing and whether you pay what your insurance for and all the rest of it. At any rate, let that be a terrible warning that the USA can do what it likes. It can spend, it's getting 19%, around about 90% of your national income going on your health service, and it's only about 9% in the UK. And as I pointed out before, Steve, who lives the longest? Is it the French? Is it the Brits? Or is it the Americans? Well, I can tell you now, the French beat the Brits and the Brits beat the Americans. And the Americans are about number 40 or 41 in the world as a whole. So they're much vaunted health service. All this propaganda about we're not socialist and we've got a top health service system. Well, you've got a good health for certain individuals. But as regards length of life, I mean, you've lost the bloody argument. You're spending that amount of money, that amount of wealth, and you can only be 41st in the world. Okay, Steve. I'd just like to have a quick word, if we could just go back to Catalonia, which is in northeast Spain. I visited there a long, long time ago, and it was when Franco, the fascist. See, what happened in 36-39, there was civil war, and a colonel who was based in Morocco, in one of those little enclaves in Morocco, those Spanish enclaves, he comes across and aided by the Germans, who were bombing, their dive bombing techniques, Spain goes fascist. But credit to Franco, he did, in fact, succeed in keeping Spain out of the Second World War. But I visited that, and this would have been in the early 60s, and was taken by, we met some people, and was taken to spend two nights in a very, very poor area of Sabadell, an industrial suburb of Barcelona. And we were introduced to people, and some, who, of course, who had never worked. And we said, well, you know, unemployment. They said, no. It's because his father was on the wrong side in the Civil War. And the vindictiveness in Spain went on for a long, long time. But there was another aspect to it of which we were aware. Whilst we were there, we were being introduced we were showing sort of the local dancing, and you were very, very, and our local singing. And even though we were an industrial suburb where people have come from all parts of Spain to get work, you were well at the Catalonia itself, and the music, very, very different. It has a genuine independence. And, of course, it was conquered like the other parts of Spain. But Spain has got about five regions in it, Steve. And I don't see why they shouldn't all go independent. This idea that you have to have all big countries together, I don't think that's the way of the future at all. I think the future must be what people want to do. Though I look askance at what Israel's policy in the Middle East, because there they and the Americans smash the place up so that they can take over, the Americans can take over control of the oil and the other assets. Look at the Bremer orders for Iraq. And the other aspect is, of course, is that any Middle East country which has been weakened, therefore, is not in a position to resist the expansion of Israel into other people's lands. But in Europe, I don't see why Scotland shouldn't go independent if it wants to. The effect on English politics, huge, because you see about 80 or 90 MPs at the moment, something like that, are Scottish, and they're all Labour with a few exceptions. And the Labour Party panicking its head off, because if there's independence, they will be erect. I can't help that. If England goes conservative, it goes conservative. I broadly favour independence of peoples, because if that's what they want, that is what they want. And they must do that. And so I'm in favour of independence for Catalonia. I'm in favour of independence for Scotland. I hope they can get it, but I don't think they don't make it. I think they are doing it in a very weak-kneed way at the moment. They don't really understand what it means to be independent. You're having to fight off something and then stand on your own two feet and do it in your own two way, or they will recapture you, which is exactly what has happened in the Middle East. You've got these movements for independence, the Arab Spring, and in no time at all they were being recaptured and controlled. That is what is going to happen to Scotland. But I favour Scotland in principle. I just don't think that they're making a good fist of it. What say you?
Yeah, I agree. And on a close vote, and apparently this is very close, with 10% of the electorate undecided in one of the polls that I saw, I forget the date of it, but that's probably still about 10% going into today's vote. In a close vote, it's so easy to rig the thing, Rodney, to make it come out the way the British government wants it to and their allies in Scotland. So I will be absolutely astounded if the yes vote wins, unless there is a tremendous surge among the undecided voters to go with the yes camp. I simply don't know if it doesn't make much sense, because if people really to be undecided and then at the last moment really come down very strongly on the side on one side as opposed to the other. But if it happened, it would be quite astounding in my mind. But again, I think that the no vote will win, and I think it's so easy if all you're doing is manipulating 1% or so. I think that really is very simple to do. Simply rig the vote to be sure the no vote wins.
Yes. I always take the view that there's no such thing as democracy when there's no economic democracy. I do think that's the crux of the matter. The vote at any one time is a very weak vote. You may or may not win, but it affects things. It can affect things substantially, but it doesn't actually accurately act on you as an individual. And only economic democracy, whatever you mean by that, but in some form, gives you the everyday power to control your life and to stand up and hold your head high and not be kicked around by others. But the democracy, what we call, is something which is so easily manipulated, though this time they've tried their manipulations, and they haven't quite won in the way that they thought that they were going to win, though they tried every trick under the book to do that, basically because that they were too smug and complacent, and the government in London thought that they had the thing in the bag, and they found out too low that they have not got it in the bag. Anyway, Steve, I wish the Scottish people well. This story is not going to go away. It will go away from the headlines, because I think whichever way it moves, the negotiations they're going to be stymied. They're going to be obstacles. The thing isn't going to work. And so, I mean, I'll see you in 2 years' time and probably say, well, they're still talking about it, or they're both trying to maneuver each other, because that you cannot have a country breaking away if it wins or loses by one vote. I mean, that's the essence of the matter. And if it wins or loses by, say, 100,000 votes in this sort of thing, the population is 5.3 million. Roughly 4.3 are registered, and about 80% of that. That would be about 3.2, something like that. 3.2 million people will probably be voting. Well, 100,000, Steve, is hardly a convincing majority. And for something like this, of this importance, I really think it should have been a requirement that you have, I don't know, would it be two-thirds, Steve? Would that be reasonable?
Oh my goodness! So on either side, Rodney, if less than two thirds says no, you just forget the whole thing. If less than two thirds says yes, you forget the whole thing. So in other words, you got this never land in the middle. It's either a two thirds vote one way or the other, or it's like a vote never happened. Is that basically what you're saying?
Well, my mind is hitting on the situation of. Let's exaggerate. One vote for independence or one vote against. Now, you know, it's like me being bald. You know, if I've got one hair, I'm bald. Or two hairs, I'm still bald. At what point do I get a full of hair? In other words, one vote, is that significant? No. Two, three, four. I presume this point. Excuse me just 1 second. I'm just going to say something. Okay. Excuse me 1 second. Come in.
Let me get one thought in, Rodney. We're getting to the end of the program. The one thing that encourages me about what's going on in Scotland today is the idea that the referendum is being held at all, the idea that ordinary people at least have a chance to decide yes or no whether they want or they don't want something. It could inspire other initiatives like this in other parts of the world, which I think would be wonderful. And if this could happen, where local people could have their say, or people of any particular country could have their say on the way they want their countries run. This I love very much in terms of how much of a majority should be required to have something like this be binding. That I'm not sure about. I'm reminded of what happened in Venezuela after Hugo Chavez came to power in 1999. He had two referenda held. He had one referendum asking the Venezuelan people whether they wanted a new constitution. Well, there was no question about getting two-thirds vote. It passed overwhelmingly. The vast majority of Venezuelans wanted it, and then they came up with a constitution, put that to a referendum vote, and again, the overwhelming majority of Venezuelans wanted what was put before them, and they cherished the ideas that were put, I mean, real democratic ideas, and they went for it, but huge majority, and I mean, this would be wonderful. This is something that I would love, but Venezuela is the exception.
Well, okay, yes, a powerful movement for doing something new, doing something radical is highly desirable. In the present situation, though, I don't think those who are pushing for independence have, in fact, got that radical move. It's a vague image. They want to, in fact, to have plenty of social security benefit, nothing wrong with that. But they're not saying, yes, and we will change our economy, we'll make it more productive, and say that we're going to go for something which really is new and exciting. Because I don't think they are prepared to challenge, which is the global financial system, in fact, to challenge the city of London. At any rate, Steve, I wish them well. But I'm afraid I'm going to take a slightly cynical view and say whichever way it goes, one way or the other, the issue is not going to be decided, and they're going to be fighting each other for quite a long time. And if it does go yes, I don't think the will to go independent and to make a real fist of it and make a go of it is there. Okay, Steve.
Oh, I agree with you, Rodney. I absolutely agree with you. I mean, it might end up just simply being much ado about nothing. With people who really think there could be constructive changes that could follow a yes vote, they'll be sorely disappointed because they won't come.
Oh, yes. The disappointment. You see, you've got these vague images, but you look at the actual realities. No new pound. They want to stay in Europe. Probably staying in NATO, though they will try and get rid of the false lane atomic base. they're relying on the that they will win. I think they will win the argument over the oil. Whether they'll actually get hold of the revenues, I can't see London allowing that for a moment. But in any case, there are questions as to whether the oil will wake up, survive for that length of time. The real issue is, have you got natural resources there, including the talents of your people? Can you develop your clean energy requirements, because that could be something you could export? And are you prepared to go for that? Are you prepared to redevelop your economy? Don't forget, Clyde's shipbuilding was one of the great triumphs of the world, and then all of Scotland's industry, including coal and iron and steel, they've all been smashed out one way or another. Scotland must re-industrialise and use its own national bank. It won't be able to do it when it has to borrow at interest from the commercial banks. That is the key to it, Steve. The reuse of their own bank for their productive capacity, and it's spreading. This is not something new. It was done by America. It was done by Canada up to 1974. It was done by Australia. But all these people have been taken over by Zionist tendency and Zionist practices and told that they can't actually use their money supply, and they have always got to borrow from the banks who are only interested with their interests and not with the interests of the people as a whole. Anyway, we're talking about big political movements, Steve. Scotland is one of them. Catalonia is another. But they are linked with UKIP in the UK, with Beppe Grillo in Italy, and with the Front National and with in France, and with the Alternative for Germany party. We're getting 10% in Germany. All of these represent a profound distrust and a rejection of the conventional political and economic policies. Indeed, it's a rejection of the political elite. That's what's really going on.
Oh, indeed. Ellen Brown has an article. I haven't read it. I just took a quick look at it, writing about a possible public bank option for Scotland. She quotes a particular individual suggesting things that Scotland really needs: establishment of an independent central bank, issuing a new Scottish debt-free currency, settling outstanding debt with the Scottish currency, taking Scotland out of the EU, taking Scotland out of NATO, establishing strict currency controls for the first 3 years of independence, nationalizing...
Oh, yes, must-have currency controls. Steve, yeah. Must-have currency controls for the first things, because the rest of the global system will try and smash you immediately, as they tried with Iceland. But don't forget, Iceland got out of it. Iceland wasn't smashed, and its debt in proportion
was
huge.
Exactly right. Scotland is tiny, but tiny Iceland, I mean, they're literally with threats against the welfare of the Icelandic state, and Iceland went its own way, and it got away with it.
Yes, indeed. Well, I'm going to wish the small countries of the world well. They can do it. They can survive. They don't have to be part of a bigger one, because as soon as that happens, they lose all flexibility. Yes, they have to cooperate with others in the world, but they must have their own supply, and that is the number one of all. By the way, I do agree with Ellen Brown and the public bank, and there must be a more sort of radical view coming from that source as to the actual uses that you use the public bank for. It's not just enough to issue debt-free money, because debt-free money is money which doesn't have to be repaid. It must be interest-free money, which is actually located and put for productive capacity. And the measure of the efficiency of that productive capacity is whether it can pay for itself. There are some weaknesses in the public, the Ellen Brown Public Bank, I would say the propaganda for it. The bottom line is whether in practice it becomes something which strengthens the real economy and spreads the real economy to every individual in the economy and the society, so that producers and consumers are the same people. That's the great principle of the free market, upheld by Adam Smith and completely rejected by today's neocon mainstream.
Oh, absolutely right. And my idea of public banking is putting money back in public hands where it belongs, getting it out of bankers' hands. And the idea that a government should pay interest on its own money is absolutely outrageous.
It's outrageous.
I mean, that's the way the U.S. system is run, the Western system is run. The U.S. Constitution says only the U.S. Treasury should be able to issue U.S. money. It talks in terms of coin, but they use different language, a couple of hundred odd years ago. America still produces its own quarters, nickels, dimes, and pennies, but that's a minute fraction function of the money supply, and the bankers control the rest of it, literally creating money out of nothing. Well, out of nothing. That's the way the money supply is created.
It's all the fault of the UK, Steve. 1695, William Paterson, and we set up the Bank of England. And the deal was is that all the private bankers would lend money to the king for his wars, and in exchange that the bank should have the profit of all the money it created out of nothing. And although there was more, that was being done in Italy beforehand, the fact of the matter is it is the UK which gave that mechanism to the English-speaking world, and from then it's gone right the way around the world. But there have been periods when, I mean, you look at American history, Philadelphia, some of your colonial experiments, that was how you became so very, very, very rich. It was when we then overthrew your experiments. I think possibly that the American War of Independence was really probably about the attempt to overthrow British financial control. The trouble was, though, is that we did it in a sort of backdoor way, that you didn't end up with your own treasury and your own money supply. You ended up selling out to the global banking system controlled by London. That's what I think probably happened.
Oh, absolutely. I think it was a financial issue that was involved in the U.S. Independence War. We're just about out of time, Roddy. The idea that it had anything to do with tea or anything else, of course, is a complete nonsense. But the good things didn't last very long, and the bad ones took over. We're just about out of time, Rodney. I look forward to getting you back again. Yeah. So many issues. They're not going away. It's amazing. We can't resolve any of these big issues from one program to the next, from one month to the next. With you as a guest, with others as a guest, the same problems fester, the same issues are the main ones, and we keep adding new ones. So we go from one war to another. It really is a horror story.
Yes, indeed, Steve. And we must keep alert, and we must keep fighting, and keep justice in the forefront of our minds.
Absolutely, okay. Ronnie. I look forward to having you back for more. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye, Steve. Bye-bye.